The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
As we hurtle toward the winter solstice, we're still not finished with the fall elections, but the state is getting ready for a new tenant in the governor's mansion. While the candidate who came oh so close is launching what could be a long winter's legal fight. Just some of what's on the menu for a new political breakfast, and we're holding a place for you. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is back with us. He is a Republican strategist and political consultant and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away for this edition, filling in this time another consultant and former Atlanta City Council President, Kathy Woolard. Welcome to you both.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the lawsuits, and we use the plural here because there are a bunch of lawsuits brought primarily by Democrats or advocates for Democratic candidates against the way elections have been held. Everything from the very specific the use of interpreters at the polls to the very general suit brought by Stacey Abrams and her backers, which basically says we need to overhaul the whole system. Brian, I'll start with you. You said this is counterproductive for Democrats.
Democrats are overplaying their hands here. They're going to hurt themselves with the very moderate, sensible voters who switched over to them from the Republicans in this last election cycle, the people who helped get Congresswoman-elect Lucy McBath elected. They're going to lose those people with these hijinks and this ridiculousness. They were on a trajectory to be a statistical majority in this country by the next election cycle. But this is why Republicans are going to stay competitive despite the numeric advantage that Democrats will soon have, because they're going to do stupid stuff like this.
On the other hand, on one of the lawsuits, a very specific one dealing with interpreters at the polls, the Secretary of State's office just agreed to a consent order which says we will make the state restrictions less restrictive, in effect admitting, if you will, at least according to voting rights advocates, that they were too restrictive to begin with, that this was making it difficult for people to vote. So it could be argued, doesn't this prove the point that Democrats are making about the system as a whole?
It proves the point that Republicans have been reasonable and sensible in looking for accommodations and looking for good ways forward. We've come to the table and come up with a solution. The problem there was something very small. It impacted a tiny amount of voters. And the laws that were on the book weren't to disenfranchise that tiny amount of voters. There were sensible reasons for why that law was the way it was. The bigger issue is Stacey Abrams and her team delegitimizing the Georgia election, which was properly and legally run. We had record turnout. They were complaining about lines and how long it took to vote. They're complaining about a lot of things that show the exact opposite of their underlying point, that there was voter suppression. We had tons of voters, more than ever.
Okay,
in a
okay. I got to get in here. You had too
ever,
many minutes.
More always. Than ever.
Let me tell you who delegitimized this election.
And that Stacey
was
Abrams.
It was Brian Kemp. He had an opportunity to step back and not supervise his own election so that people could feel like there was an independent election like we've had every single time. That was the first bad step. I don't think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be, that the Secretary of State's office has won a single lawsuit. We're now at five that have been filed just this year on different things, and I can run through what they are. The signature match, that got thrown out. Because the people's ballots were being marked provisional if they wrote Catherine M. Woolard in one way and then left the M out. That's ridiculous. Proof of citizenship. people got thrown out because they were marked as potentially non-citizens, and they didn't have a way to easily prove that they were. That got thrown out. How provisional ballots were treated, that got thrown out. Absentee birth dates. If you forgot to put your birth date on your absentee return, your absentee ballot got thrown out. Now we have this other thing about interpreters. All of these are death by a thousand cuts for voters. And, you know, we talked earlier, you know, I'm helping my elderly parents vote. They literally can't get an absentee ballot in and out for this runoff so that they can conveniently vote. And they never miss a vote. So I think right now, until there's a trend of the Secretary of State's office winning some of these lawsuits, I think that the point is made.
It's not death by a thousand cuts. It is apathy by a thousand lies. Look at the list of lies that Democrats have told about the voting systems in this state. One, Brian Kemp has registered more voters than any Secretary of State in the history of Georgia. Two, a lot of these issues that Kathy and Democrats are raising are decided at the county level. The county election board system is much more powerful than the Secretary of State's office in many of these election-related decisions. Remember all the hoopla over closing down precincts in Democrat counties? Well, if you dug a little bit, you found out that those were Democrat county officials making those decisions. And guess what? They were closing Trump precincts in their counties, not the minority ones. And the New York Times, Washington Post, all writing about it. I don't remember anybody writing a correction saying, wait, that wasn't true. And all these exact matches in the 57, 60-something thousand, whatever it was, people on the provisional list, many of those were people signed up by Stacey Abrams's dark money group, and those people were reached out to continuously by the state. They never responded because they never intended to vote.
What would you say, though, to the argument from progressives that it isn't how many voters were registered, it's how many voters were kept from voting in order to keep the turnout as low as possible on the Democratic side? Kathy referenced death by a thousand cuts. If you look at purging voters, curtailing voting hours, being forced to reinstate voters, the argument is this all has a disproportionate effect on minority voters. And if you look at each one, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and it has webbed feet like a duck, then it's a duck.
No, you have the national media coming in saying it's a duck. That's what you have here. We have not curtailed voting hours. If you don't get to the polls in Georgia, which from absentees, from the early voting to your precinct in your neighborhood, then you're just not trying too hard. 2 million people showed up to vote for Stacey Abrams. The idea that there was any suppression when we had a record midterm turnout is ludicrous, and they are hurting Georgia's democracy, and they're not telling the truth.
Well, again, Secretary of State's office has lost every single lawsuit on these issues, and so I think that's an area of concern. Every single one. You could debate one off, but every single one. Second thing is, you know, the Secretary of State's office needs to lead a coherent election system amongst these 159 counties we have. I agree that that's a problem, but that's what the Secretary of State's office is to do. Here in the city of Atlanta, we vote across two counties, and during the mayor's election, DeKalb County had different early voting rules and different length of time rules for the elections. That's unfair. You know, that's unfair for candidates who have support crossing those things. So we need to have a Secretary of State's office that is really going to guide fair elections, train these precincts so that the yahoos out there, whether they're Republican-led or Democratic-led or whatever you want to call it, or they're just plain incompetent and we don't care what they are, so that we have competent elections across the state. And I submit that's the role of the Secretary of State's office.
All of this plays into the December 4th runoff for Secretary of State. Brad Raffensperger, a Republican and Democrat, and former Congressman John Barrow, they're in the runoff. Kathy Woolard, Democrats have made the Secretary of State's office an issue, but do they care enough to show up and vote for John Barrow in a state where Republicans are still able to win statewide elections consistently?
You know, I don't know. We're going to find out. It's of concern right now, the turnout, and I think that's one of the fallacies of having this runoff system that we have in Georgia. You know, you have a runoff that comes right after Thanksgiving. People are gone. They forget about the election, and then they got to come back and get absentee ballots or make a plan to go vote, and it is very difficult to keep up. You know, I think we have to change that system. Very few states operate runoffs like this, and it's a disservice, frankly, to everybody.
This may surprise folks, but I totally agree with Kathy 100% on that. I have used this platform and many others to say we need ranked voting so that we have an instant runoff during the general election. You vote for your favorite person and then your second favorite and then your third, whatever it is.
And that is something that John Barrow advocated.
And I agree with him on this.
Yeah.
So you agree with the Democrat on this?
Absolutely, because it's not a partisan issue.
No. He advocated this in a debate that my colleague Rose Scott did.
Yeah.
So anyway, continue with your point.
I'm all for that. Not only does it save voters and people like Kathy's parents who had trouble getting an absentee ballot during this short runoff period, a second trip to the polls, it saves taxpayers literally millions and millions of dollars. I mean, think about it. So we all benefit, the donors, the candidates, the voters, the taxpayers. Let's get rid of this crazy system. And Republicans in runoffs in Georgia, at least, have a built-in advantage. I don't know why that is. Maybe we're just better turnout operation in a runoff. Democrats have several challenges here. One, Republicans always do better in runoffs. Two, there's no influential vote turnout candidate at the top of the ticket, like a Stacey Abrams, who's going to energize minority voters. The idea that African-American voters and others are going to show up for two white Democrats when that's all that's on the ballot just seems unlikely to me. It's going to be low turnout regardless. There's still a chance, and these runoffs are unpredictable. But I would imagine, and I would be shocked, if Brad Raffensperger and Chuck Eaton are not elected on Tuesday.
Chuck Eaton is the Republican running for PSC. He is running Public Service Commission, and he is running against Democratic challenger Lindy Miller. Kathy, let's start with you on this one. This election has been fought mostly on Plant Vogtle, whether we ought to continue the construction, the expansion of nuclear Plant Vogtle, who should pay for it, all of this. Again, do Democratic voters, while they might gripe about nuclear power and the costs of it, do they care enough to show up?
Well, we'll see. I don't know. Again, when you look at the demographics of Democratic voters, you have a larger portion of the voters that are poor, who lack transportation, who find getting information difficult. They might be disconnected from things that are going on online or other kinds of sources where they get information. And so that's a disadvantage. And again, ranked voting would help with that. And I think, again, when you have runoffs, it's really a matter of being able to sort of keep up and make things happen, like this absentee thing. You can't really mobilize people who are disenfranchised via absentee ballots when you have literally 5 days, six really, to submit, get it, return it, and have that vote registered.
But is nuclear a galvanizing issue? It's the one that Lindy Miller has hammered on. But is that the one that will get people out if you're trying to win as a Democrat?
It's a tough issue. It's not one that has you'd think it has received a lot of press. I certainly know about it. But it's a complicated issue that I don't think strikes people at their heart. Electric bills are something that you sort of just pay and you don't understand what's behind it. I don't think that it's a motivating. It certainly is for me and my bubble, but I don't know if that's the thing that gets people out.
Brian, on the other hand, Debbie Dooley, who is one of the founders of the Tea Party movement in Georgia, and we should point out here, the Tea Party movement is hardly a single force. It has had lots of people of differing approaches in it. Debbie Dooley just won, but one of the more prominent ones, she's endorsed Lindy Miller here.
Yeah. Debbie's being paid for that, by the way. She's now sort of bought and paid for by those interests. So this is not a stand on principle by Debbie Dooley. And she is someone who sort
of— She has been on this for a long time.
She's been on it for a long time.
On nuclear power.
The way that you've been in the media for a long time because it was your job and you got paid to do it. Yeah. So it's very similar in that way. And what Lindy Miller is trying to do is have it both ways. She won't say, no, I would vote against Vogtle. She just wants to hang it out there as something to attack Chuck Eaton on without taking the stand that she would stop it, because Georgia taxpayers, ratepayers rather, have already invested a lot of money in this. And
it's the good money after bad argument, though.
But we're going to get there. the contractor went bankrupt, which nobody in the PSC could have foreseen or would be responsible for. There were problems. I think Chuck Eaton and Trisha Pridemore and the other members of the PSC are very frustrated by how slow the progress has been. I think Georgia Power is frustrated by how slow the progress has been. But Democrats who want to talk about global warming and climate change in campaigns can't then turn around and say we are against diversifying our energy sources to provide no carbon energy, which is what this is. We are leading in this nation, just like we did on criminal justice reform. This is another example of Georgia being on the leading edge. We are making tough choices. We're making some sacrifices, but this is going to pay off in the long run.
This is a money pit.
If you need another reason to vote against Lindy Miller, vote against her just because she says it's Miller time. It's just so trite and disgusting.
Well, I hadn't heard that, and I don't really care about trite and disgusting. She's got a point. The Vogtle is a money pit to the state. It is diversifying in one area that is highly questionable, and we're not spending the same kind of money on wind, on solar, on other kinds of things that we could spend more money on. I think that the Public Service Commission should cut Georgia Power off on this one. If they want to build it, let them keep funding it out of whatever they're funding things out of, and move on into the next century. We've got to get moving, and this thing is not going to get fixed.
This is how we move into the next century, and the issues that she is raising, that we need to do more solar and all these other renewables, is you can't scale them yet in such a way to produce what you're going to produce at Vogtle. We've got to have some energy efficiency. It's got to be affordable and sustainable.
They have argued over the scale of solar development. Both say, let's develop solar. Chuck Eaton says, we have to emphasize utility-scale solar.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Big projects, big solar projects. Lindy Miller says, let's incentivize individuals too, people who put solar on their roofs and all that kind of thing. They argued this in a debate with, again, my colleague Rose Scott on Closer Look just recently. Is there a way to do both?
Sure, there is. I think you have to decide that that's what you want to do. I mean, we didn't think, well, I don't know how many years, 10 years ago, that we'd have a film industry in Georgia.
Right.
But we created the incentives that became the tipping point that got us to where we need. If we want to do something about climate change and we want to do something about renewable energy, then we need to think about good policy and put it into place. But putting all your eggs in one basket isn't going to do it.
I don't think Chuck Eaton or any Republican on the PSC is against people putting solar panels on their rooftops.
But putting money into it?
What they're focused on from that level is providing energy to the highest number of Georgians at the lowest possible cost. So that should be the focus of the state right now. What we're talking about here is very small scale.
And you can hear those debates on Closer Look with Rose Scott for the PSC and for the Secretary of State runoff elections by just going to our website, wabe.org/closerlook. And we'll be back with more of the Political Breakfast in just a moment. Stay right here.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Good to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining us this time, Republican strategist Brian Robinson, who is a public affairs communications consultant and former deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal, and another public affairs consultant and former Atlanta City Council president Kathy Willard, who's filling in for Theron Johnson this time. Let's pick up on something we talked about in our last podcast, which is some of the issues facing Governor-elect Kemp. Brian, I'll start with you. We talked about the religious freedom bills that might come up in the legislature, which he pledged during the campaign he would sign as long as they fell in line with federal religious freedom legislation. There is substantial opposition to this in the business community. Have we learned anything new about what position Governor-elect Kemp might be in, or whether there is help for him in the legislature, even from Republicans, to keep a bill like that from ever getting to his desk and putting him in the difficult position of having to either keep or break a campaign promise?
Where we need to begin is not with what are the repercussions of a RFRA bill. We need to start with, do we have a problem in Georgia? Are there people of faith being discriminated against because they are exercising their religious rights? And I would offer to you that we don't have a problem. every case cited by RFRA proponents about local governments prosecuting exercising of religion has been, the case has been found in favor of the person of faith. Every single one.
So you're saying this is a solution in search of a problem.
Absolutely. Yes. And I've been saying this for 3 years, since before Governor Deal vetoed that RFRA bill in 2016. We know if we determined that there was a problem, we would then go to step two, which is what are the repercussions? Mm-hmm. And they're going to be, we're going to have bad media during the Super Bowl when all these people are here. We're going to lose the movie studios who are filming at Pinewood in Fayette County. And you're going to see boycotts of the state and our convention and tourism trades. And there will be significant repercussions for something that doesn't move the needle for people of faith.
But the governor-elect has made that promise, and there are folks in the legislature who will make sure to produce those bills. So what happens?
We have a big old fight. Starting in January, we've been having this fight. The battle lines are drawn very, very clearly. The repercussions are proven. It's not a question about what's going to happen. And here's what the General Assembly needs to focus on: healthcare reform. That has been teed up for discussion forever.
You're talking about Medicaid expansion, among other things.
Or of some sort. Transportation and infrastructure. One could make a case that one of the problems we had with the Amazon deal, I was a little ambivalent about that, but regardless, businesses are concerned about coming to a place where people can't get around. And education. We've got to have a workforce ready for the future. If the General Assembly only did that and proportional voting? I mean,
not proportional voting.
Rank voting, on which we can agree.
Yeah.
Then I think we'd have a good session. But to spend another minute after spending, 5 years now, every session dragging this ridiculous problem in search of a solution through the mud, I think is a waste of time. And I don't think that's a way for administration to get off.
You know, one thing of note here is that the major proponents of RFRA in the House and Senate are now gone. Josh McCoon ran for Secretary of State unsuccessfully.
He lost in the primary.
He really pushed that in the Senate. He was probably the most articulate and forceful voice on that issue. And I respect him greatly, even though we disagree on this issue. He is at least he's one of the most thoughtful legislators that I have seen during my time at the Gold Dome. Sam Teasley, who lost mm-hmm. his reelection race in Cobb County.
He made
it
to the general, but lost. In his district.
He lost in his district and will be replaced by
Mary Frances Williams.
Yes. So it'll be interesting.
And David Schaefer lost.
And Schaefer, of course, is no longer there either. Now, granted, there's still some major backers of this in the Senate. But for the most part, the biggest and most articulate voices on the issue are now on the sidelines.
Couldn't it be argued, though, Kathy, that we saw Stacey Abrams, for instance, and others step in and say, after boycotts were threatened because of the general election result in the governor's race, after boycotts were threatened, Stacey Abrams herself came in and said, look, boycotts are going to be counterproductive here because of the loss of jobs. Couldn't backers of RFRA make the same point and say, look, boycotts will hurt the wrong people, and you need to just let this fight go, and the governor will sign it or not?
I think the two issues, while they may seem similar, are different. The RFRA fight has been well established, and the outcomes have been clear. There have been boycotts that worked, if you will. That's not the usual case. Boycotts following an election, I'm not sure the mojo's there, really. So I don't think you can really compare the two things.
For us, it's up and down the income scale. But yeah, when you have fewer people in hotels coming for conventions, it's the people who clean the rooms and tend the bars and check you in and take your bags to your room who get hurt. Yeah, no doubt.
You know, Georgia Tech, for one example, graduates probably more engineers and technology folks than just about any university in the country. Those young people, you know, have choices. They can go to a state where they don't have to deal with this mess, where they don't have to risk that maybe they don't get a job or they don't get a promotion because they got a boss that's got a law that says they can discriminate against them with impunity. You know, we don't need that.
Let's move to the city of Atlanta, because it was in the news along with other cities around the country this past week. Kathy, I'll start with you since you know your way around City Hall a bit. Two citizens of Iran were indicted in connection with that ransomware attack that froze the city of Atlanta's government computers and others in governments around the nation. This was the SAMSAM ransomware attack. Two-part question, will we ever know for sure whether the city paid the demanded ransom? There's been some back and forth about that. And number two, have we learned any lessons from this the city can put in to try to keep this from happening in the future?
Well, this is a very dangerous circumstance, and it's a global problem, right? You know, we've talked about it in many instances, including national elections, when foreign entities or even local entities can, you know, hack into a system and bring it to a halt. That's a global problem, and it's difficult to solve because it changes all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm very much for government transparency. The issue of whether the city of Atlanta paid the ransom or not is a very delicate one, because you know ransoms are difficult, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't really have anything to say much one way or the other. But I think the issue is for the city of Atlanta is their technology up to snuff, and are they thinking ahead? And this goes for every jurisdiction. I'm not picking on Atlanta, but you know I just got my business license renewal email reminding me to renew my business license, and it got sent to me in an email, and every single business owner in Atlanta was visual on the CC, right? They sent it in just a personal email.
So they could see the email that came to you.
Thousands. I could see them.
Not a good thing.
Not a good thing. And so simple. I mean, like here you have your business license renewal and you're sending it out in a personal email, not through an email system. So this is really, you know, this is a problem that the city has got to get on top of and really look top down and be on it all the time. And it's going to cost a lot of money, but it has to be, you know, core one of what the city pays attention to.
I want to cut the city and the mayor some slack on this, actually, because no one yet has proven they can stay ahead of the hackers around the world. And of course, we're not ever going to get these Iranians. There's no extradition process between our countries. I would not be shocked if they're state-sponsored in some way. That would not surprise me. These guys are evil enemies of the United States. And whether or not a ransom was paid, and certainly the stories want to suggest that something was paid on behalf of this, it very well could be that law enforcement federally made this decision, and the city is unable to respond in a transparent way. They may be part of a much bigger operation. I don't think that Keisha Lance Bottoms is out there dealing with these hackers and paying the ransoms on her own without dealing with the FBI and perhaps even other intelligence agencies in the United States government. So I cut them some slack. I'm not sure they're driving this bus.
Doesn't this raise the question, though, with a legislature just starting? The state has shown, particularly in the Secretary of State's office, that inadvertent things can happen. There's possible vulnerabilities there. And that's just one agency of the state. That governments at every level have to be prepared to spend a whole lot of money on data security.
Yeah. I mean, and again, we got 159 counties, each one creating its own election rules, you know. I mean, just as an example of the kinds of things, the kinds of trouble that you could get into. So, you know, I could see a specialized committees on the House and Senate side really looking into these issues. I mean, we need to make sure every jurisdiction, not just Atlanta, every single jurisdiction, and there are thousands of them in Georgia, have the resources to protect our citizens against these kinds of invasions.
It's going to have to be a federal and national effort. We can't do it piecemeal city by city because you're going to have some cities that don't have the resources that can be much more vulnerable. And, of course, not every city has information as valuable as other cities. So we're going to need a federal system that protects us with a blanket that goes coast to coast. I don't know how we do that. I'm not smart enough to know that. But we can't go to the city of Atlanta and go, hey, you guys got to fight off Iran. You know, not going to work.
Some time for quick thoughts from each of you on a couple of other things that happened in the last week or two. Congressman Drew Ferguson, who's from the West Point area of Georgia, Republican, who's only in his second term, is now the new House Chief Deputy Whip. He's working with Republican Whip Steve Scalise in a Republican caucus that's going to be in the minority as of the first of the year. But this is a big deal for Georgia. Brian, I'll start with you. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people in this area don't even know who Drew Ferguson is. They're going to.
Yeah. Drew is a great guy, by the way. Just super nice, down to earth, very smart legislator. Somebody who never served in office before being elected 2 years ago. He had been a dentist in West mm-hmm. Point before that.
So and what makes Steve Scalise pick him?
He's easy to get along with, and he's a team player, and he has shown that he's a prolific fundraiser, which has caught the attention of the White House. He's even getting people pushing him there for that position. So he's made friends in a very short period of time because he plays well in the sandbox. That is the secret to it.
Can he decide which fights to pick and which fights to give in on when it comes to dealing with Nancy Pelosi, presumably, might be the next speaker?
Well, that's not going to be something that he's deciding on his own. There's leaders ahead of him. Here's what it means. Is Georgia has a seat in the leadership room of the Republican Party in the House when we are putting together budget priorities that include such things as the Port of Savannah.
Mm-hmm. And Port of Savannah funding, by the way, survived another round of budget. Of course, there's more to go on that.
Also important in fighting the Alabama senators who are constantly putting in stuff on the Senate side to hurt our water rights.
Oh, the water wars. Yes, they do that even after Jeff Sessions left the Alabama delegation. That continues, Kathy.
Well, I'm glad we've got somebody in there, and hopefully Georgia will be well looked after. We need a lot of money for infrastructure down here, for transportation, all those things I just mentioned. So hopefully we'll benefit from that.
Meanwhile, Kathy, a leading Democrat who has said before, I will not be running for office, said again, hey, you didn't hear me the first time. I'm not running for office. Sally Yates, former acting U.S. Attorney General.
I don't know why people don't listen to women. Sally said it clearly right when she got home. She's still saying it. She ain't running.
Is it a setback for Democrats, though, as they try to build their bench here?
Oh, no. I mean, listen, Sally wants to do anything, I'm right there for. But, you can't hold your whole party's hopes on one person. You know, we need to build a bench that's deep and wide and can accommodate a lot of points of view, and she'll find what she wants to do in due time, and I'm sure she'll be great.
She has an active Twitter account. I'm sure we'll be hearing from her.
Sally Yates obviously has raised her profile not only in Georgia but nationally, and has gained a lot of respect, particularly amongst Democrats, for taking on President Trump in the early days of his administration. Oftentimes, though, when we have these dream candidates, in reality, they turn out to be not great candidates. That's very normal. People who have made a profile in other careers, the transition is much more difficult than you think. So I'm not sure that she would have been this incredible candidate that they think she is. She's obviously charming, and she's
she would be a fierce debater.
She's smart.
And she's smart. Yeah, and she's competent and did a good job running the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Atlanta and got bipartisan support for it. The second thing is I'm not sure that someone of her profile can win a statewide Democratic primary in today's atmosphere. One, there is a built-in advantage for African-American candidates in the Democratic primary now. And nationally, Democrats are so angry and unhinged that someone as sensible and calm and non-bomb-throwing as Sally Yates really isn't going to break through the noise.
Yeah, let's move on. we're just talking stupid now.
It's true. Sally Yates could not win it. She couldn't win.
No, she could, but stop it. Let's just move on.
Moving on to another Georgia name, which has become very prominent recently, Nick Ayers, who was a former, pretty much a low-level staffer for gubernatorial candidate Sonny Perdue at the time, is now the chief of staff to Vice President Pence. He is at the center of White House chief of staff speculation, a lightning rod of a figure even within the Republican Party. Brian, does Nick Ayers become White House chief of staff?
There are a lot of indicators pointing toward that, and talk about Georgia having a seat at the table. Nick was named Georgian of the Year by James Magazine, mm-hmm. and I went to an event for him honoring that last week. He talked in there about how he's even made fun of by the president because he's such an evangelist, that was his word, for Georgia. So it would be great for Georgia to have his voice there. You mentioned him being a low-level staffer. That was 2002.
I know.
He was 19 years old.
He was a baby.
He was a Kennesaw State student, and he was Sonny's body guy. But fast forward 4 years of 06, he was the reelect campaign chair. In 07, he was the ED, executive director of the Republican Governors Association. And 4 years later, under his guidance, Republicans won more governorships, over 30. than they had ever gotten in history. So he has an extraordinary record of success. I mean, here he's somebody who was going in and doing Mike Pence's reelect in Indiana. Mm-hmm. Pence got plucked up. So that was how Nick ended up in the White House. The guy is a winner. You can throw him up in the air 1,000 times, and 99% of the time he's going to land on his feet. And he's an amazing fella. And I'm proud that he's a friend of mine and used to be my wife's boss.
Democrats, Kathy, though, have raised questions about some of the various consulting entities that Nick Ayers has been involved in and the sources of funding and disclosure of finances and so forth and possible conflicts of interest. But this is the White House chief of staff. It doesn't have to go for Senate confirmation or anything like that. And Democrats in Congress are going to have to deal with whoever the chief of staff is, Nick Ayers or somebody else. So do you fight that fight?
Oh, no, and I don't think they will. I think people are being asked for commentary on stuff that's out there. As to Nick, I say bless his heart. This could be, the sign of success not being the best thing that could happen for you. He's going to be in a White House that's difficult, at best, and try to make sense of it. And, good for him. It's a good thing he's young because it kind of takes that sort of energy to be able to do that.
He's obviously built the trust of the president. And one thing they discussed last week at that event was that every week, the president, vice president, and General Kelly, the president's chief of staff, and Nick get together for lunch. And it is in those lunches that Nick has been able to build this bond with President Trump. And one thing Secretary Perdue, Nick's former boss, mm-hmm. said in his presentation was, Nick's job is to go in and tell the president things he doesn't want to hear sometimes. And he's got a special gift for being able to do that, to deliver the hard news and steer the ship of state.
One more thought on the city. Kathy, we'll start with you on this. City Councilman Ivory Lee Young, a leader on the West Side for decades, passed away, and now there's an open seat. Just as the West Side comes into focus in a big way, economically and politically, because of development there, the Beltline, of course, Mercedes-Benz and Arthur Blank's plans for developing the West Side, this is a big moment for the West Side in terms of deciding its future now that it's lost one of its key leaders.
Yeah, Ivory came on council during the time that I was there as a younger man and was, somebody who was just very kind and passionate.
He came out of the neighborhood planning units.
Yeah, and really stayed, true to his home, and we're going to miss him. I mean, he was really somebody who had a lot of passion for the people, and I'm just sorry that he has had such a rough time and we're just going to miss him. But it is an important election. It's a seat that could potentially be a swing seat in the 7-8 configuration that a mayor is always looking for. I think you'll see the mayor, having a candidate in this hunt, the business community, and those things might be aligned. And then I think that there are going to be neighborhood interest and, change-focused organizations that will have their candidate or candidates in there. I expect we'll see a robust field. I've heard Mabel Thomas is considering a run. She usually
former
sort
member
of
the city council, now in the state legislature, where she's been before.
Yeah, she's kind of bounced back and forth between the two things. So, I wouldn't be surprised at that. Greg Clay ran against Ivory last time. My guess is I'd see him there. I know that there are a few other candidates that are shaping up. So this will be a big election, and I think it's going to be held in March.
Yeah, and the issues are going to be huge.
Yep.
Like we just mentioned, Beltline, development, affordable housing, the role of Mercedes-Benz Stadium, mm-hmm. Arthur Blank's plans for the West Side.
Yep.
There's a lot to chew on here.
There is. It's a big one.
On a lighter note, this has been, again, hugely busy time for sports in this city and this region. Georgia Tech's football coach Paul Johnson retired. Brian, I know as a Georgia Bulldog fan, you were very sorry to see that. UGA pushing for the NCAA playoffs, trying to get into that field of four. Brian McCann comes home to the Braves, and Atlanta United packs the house. This is a really dynamic time for sports in the city. And it affects people whether they're sports fans or not.
Well, wait a minute. You didn't mention Georgia playing Alabama on Saturday. Can I just tell you, I'm just sort of living for that.
Yeah. But,
I'm going home. I'm just going to sit in front of the TV till Saturday.
Are you a Bulldog?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Oh, good.
See?
There's more commonality.
She's wearing red and black.
You just got to talk and reach across the aisle. That's all you got to do.
I'd say I'm going to be there. on Saturday and pulling on the dogs, and I just can't get my hopes up. Like, I can't let them break my heart again. The 2012 SEC championship game was something that I still am not completely over. Much don't get me started on the 2017
national
championship
game.
where we were robbed. I mean, we won the national championship, and I would say this to my friend Jerry Moorhead, president of the University of Georgia: hang a national championship banner in Stanford Stadium. We won. We were robbed. The NCAA is corrupt. Tyler Simmons was onside. We won that game, fair and square. And I have less hope about Saturday, so I will be walking on clouds the next time I'm here if we somehow pull off this. Because if we win this, if we win Saturday, we're going to be national champions because we are obviously peaking at the right time.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist and political consultant and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Theron Johnson this time, another consultant, former Atlanta City Council President Kathy Woolard. Thanks to you both.
Go Dawgs!
Yeah, sick 'em.
And if you like this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. And we will be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.